Hello, I'm Peter Anthony Holder. Yeah, that guy. This is number 0600, the Stuff File program with that guy, Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0600. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet folk music icon Melanie, who was one of only three solo women to perform at Woodstock. What was that heady experience like for a shy 22-year-old?
They didn't know me. They didn't know my face. They didn't know my image. There was nothing, you know. So when I did go on, I connected instantly with the 500,000 people that were there, which was remarkable in itself. And I had a very outstanding, unbelievable experience. I actually left my body, and I wasn't doing any drugs.
Robert G. Penner is the author of the post-apocalyptic novel Strange Labor.
There's a post-apocalyptic event. There's this massive event in which the largest proportion of humanity wakes up one morning and just leaves the cities and starts digging these massive earthen moundworks, these labyrinths or mazes out in the countryside. And they cease talking. They're just doing this all together. And there's a small fragment of the population that is not participating and doesn't understand what's happening or why it's happening.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guests later. The person who told you this was show number 0600, well, that was me, Peter Anthony Holder, the host of the Stuff File program. Yes, I do the guests late to every, 100 shows. So here we are with our 600th. So there you go. Hope to see you back here for our 700th and all the other shows in between. Here on the Stuff File program, which is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff. Unless you've been under a rock, you know that Tom Brady and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers won Super Bowl 55, out-dueling Patrick Mahomes and the Kansas City Chiefs in a dominant 31-9 victory at Raymond James Stadium. But something else happened during the game. You might also know that whenever some moron runs onto the field from the stands, it is standard practice that camera crews don't show them on the field because that only encourages others to be morons in the future. And that indeed happened late in the third quarter when a fan snuck onto the field wearing a mankini advertising an adult site. CBS cut away from the telecast, going to a commercial, as field security apprehended the trespasser. But Kevin Harlan, who called the game from the radio booth, treated fans to a hilarious Super Bowl-worthy call as the situation unfolded.
Second down, 20, 5:03 to go. Someone has run on the field. Some guy with a bra. And now he's not being chased. He's running down the middle of the 40. Arms in the air and a victory salute. He's pulling down his pants. Put up your pants, my man. Pull up those pants. He's being chased to the 30. He breaks a tackle from a security guard. The 20, down the middle, the 10, the 5. He slides at the 1, and they converge on him at the goal line. Pull up your pants. Take off the bra and be a man. And the players with hands on hips at the other end of the field are looking at him and shaking their head and saying, why, oh, why is this taking place in a Super Bowl?
That's a call for the ages. Thank you, Kevin. You are awesome. On January 7th, police received a call from a 7-Eleven store in Lehi, Utah, where earlier in the day, a man wearing a sheriff's deputy jacket stole a donut, then left in a white pickup truck. Lehi police examined surveillance video and tracked the truck to a nearby motel parking lot where they knocked on the door of 47-year-old Daniel Mark Wright, who was staying there. As officers spoke with Wright, they saw a Salt Lake County sheriff's jacket hanging in the room's closet. They arrested Wright for impersonation of an officer and theft, along with receiving or transfer of a stolen vehicle in relation to the truck. Wright, his companion, Christian Olson, and another accomplice are also under investigation for racketeering. Well, pretending to be a cop to steal donuts sounds like a joke, doesn't it? Well, I guess the joke's on Daniel. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, here's another criminal for you. 32-year-old Leobardo Hernandez of Pomona, California, went to extraordinary lengths on January 16th to evade police after allegedly stealing a car. As Hernandez ran from officers, he entered an apartment complex and found an unlocked door. The apartment residents were not at home, so Hernandez moved right in, shaving his face, changing clothes, and even cooking tortillas to make it seem like he lived there. Unfortunately, he also burned the tortillas, summoning the fire department. Hernandez eventually surrendered and was charged with burglary and possession of a stolen vehicle, among other offenses. So, not only is he not good at crime, he also isn't good at cooking. Well, maybe the justice system can kill two birds with one stone by making him work in the prison kitchen. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Folk singing icon Melanie has been nominated for a Lifetime Achievement Award by the International Folk Music Awards. She has had a career that is still going strong for over 50 years. Melanie joins us on the line from Nashville. Hi, Melanie.
Hi.
Nice to talk to you. I've got to start right off the bat by gushing a little bit. I remember when your single, Brand New Key, came out. I wore that copy out.
That's amazing. It's so, you know, funny because it's 50 years since the release of that on my own record label. I was a renegade, and I was the only artist ever, except for the Beatles, to open a record label. And they had all kinds of legal people involved. But here I was with my husband, and we opened Neighborhood Records, and we released Brand New Key and had a hit. And it flew in the face of a lot of industry standard practice industry people. So I, without realizing what I had been doing, what I did is I made enemies. But there I was with Brand New Key. And it was actually banned on a lot of radio stations. But the B-side, do you remember what the B-side was?
No, I don't. Please refresh my memory.
Well, I'm just curious about that because everybody said I should put something similar on the B-side. And I said, no, I want people to know that, you know, there's some substance here, you know, that I'm a writer. And so I put a song called Some Say I Got Devil. It's a really introspective, passionate song, but it's so not like Brand New Key, and everyone had a problem with me putting that on the B-side. And I said, I'm really glad I did that because there are people who will probably maybe have turned that record over and thought, what's this? Because it's very dark, you know, compared to Brand New Key. On the other hand, people bought the record, so you want to hear what you paid for. So I'm sure there were a lot of people who did turn over their record, and that is probably why I have a lifelong relationship with so many of my followers, and I call them my dear ones, you know, like people who've been with me forever. Again, they were mostly the younger brothers and sisters of people who were a little older than me at that time, because I don't know, I was there was an agenda going on, and I was made to look less than brilliant.
I have to admit, you know, growing up, I grew up in a soul and R&B family, so folk music was not something that I would generally listen to growing up. But as I said, Brand New Key was an amazing song.
Yeah.
I still get goosebumps whenever I play Lay Down. And also, look what they've done to my song, Ma, is a song that is just a joy to listen to. And you talk about the fact that you started your own record label. You've had problems and issues over the career, like so many musicians have had, with dealing with labels. How did you break out and become your own label, as it were, with a song like Brand New Key?
I always wrote, you know, and I wrote mostly for myself. I didn't really think of myself as a writer, and I certainly was not touted as a writer. In fact, they didn't have a category called singer-songwriter. There was just Bob Dylan, who wrote songs and sang them, so they called me the female Bob Dylan at that time. So, you know, I wanted not to be perceived as this sort of bliss ninny that the record company was promoting me as. And I wanted to be able to, you know, do things like put some say on the back of the B-side of Brand New Key and be able to, first of all, they didn't know what kind of music to call it, because if you really want to look at Brand New Key, it is a blues song. It was produced as a pop record, but it is blues. In fact, when I sang it to my husband, who's a producer, he heard it and he said, "Oh, that's a hit." I said, "What are you talking about?" Because I was doing it like, "I got a brand new pair of roller skates. You got a brand new key." Yeah. You know, so it is very much a blues song. But I was all over the map because, well, my mom was a jazz singer. My uncle was a union organizing labor songs person. And my dad played the saxophone. My grandmother was from Italy, so she sang Italian songs without any announcement. She would just break into song here and there. So I grew up in a really musical family, and they were all over the map. You know, my mom listened to standards and Billie Holiday and Peggy Lee. And then I discovered La Dolina and the music of Kurt Vile and Three Penny Opera. And you know, that was what I loved, that chanteuse thing, you know, the Edith Piaf. So those were my early influences, and they kind of came out in different ways. So they really didn't know what genre I was in, but because I have long hair and those buffalo sandals that everybody wore then, they were like made of buffalo hide, and you had to soak them and put your feet in them for several days so they took on the shape of your foot. Otherwise, they were painful to wear. But I wore those, and I had a guitar I played, and so I must be a folk singer. But really, when you listen to some of the songs, they're really not very folky. In fact, for many years, the folk music people, because I had hit, kind of a little bit shunned me.
So then how does it feel 50 years later to be nominated for a Lifetime Achievement Award by the International Folk Music Awards?
Well, I think I must have pushed the envelope to really and truly, because things that are called folk songs, you know, aren't really folk songs in the traditional sense of telling the news of the day. In it's much, much broader category. And Americana kind of oozes into it, but the category itself is a broader category.
I mentioned earlier the song "Candle in the Wind," and you say you're "Candle in the Rain," rather. "Candle in the Rain." My mistake. I mentioned "Candle in the Rain," and as you say, you're not necessarily a folk singer. I mean, you had the Edwin Hawkins Singers as your background, as your backup in that song, and it's just amazing. How did that come together?
Well, I was I wrote that song leaving Woodstock, and I had that anthemic part, and that whole experience was swimming around in my head. And when I got the song together, I played it to Peter, and I thought, wouldn't it be great? Because I was on, at that point, Buddha Records, and they had just had the hit with the Edwin Hawkins Singers' "Oh Happy Day," And I said, wouldn't it be amazing if the Edwin Hawkins singers sang that lay down chorus with me? And he said, yeah. And my husband was a very extrovert person, you know. And I was the absolute opposite. But he actually contacted the Edwin Hawkins singers. He was on the phone one day, and he'd do these things like, hey, Melanie, there's someone who really wants to talk to you. And he'd put me on the phone, and I'd be like, who is this? Who is this? And it was Edwin Hawkins, and he asked me to tell him a little bit about the song. And then he asked me, what do you have a reference to Jesus in the song? And I went, no, not exactly. Well, is the Lord mentioned in the song? Not really. I mean, he's kind of there, but, you know, not by name. And he said, oh, I'm sorry, honey. You know, I can't. We only do religious songs to praise the Lord. And I'm sorry. Okay, well, I guess that's that, you know. Yeah, I'm sure. I wish you a lot of luck, you know, and that was that. So I'm figuring that, well, that's, you know, I tried, but it didn't work. We were in San Francisco recording with Freddie Kutera, who was the engineer for Simon and Garfunkel, and legendary engineer, Freddie Kutera. We're in the studio, and I guess Peter found out that the Edwin Hawkins singers were rehearsing in a gymnasium in Oakland. So he said, oh, Edwin Hawkins wants to meet you. And I said, are you sure? So we went to where they were rehearsing, and I could hear this huge sound coming from the auditorium before we opened the door. And there I am, opened the door with a guitar and Peter, and they stopped dead, you know, and they like looked at this, what's this, you know? I mean, again, I looked like a folk singer. I certainly didn't look like a pop singer or a gospel singer. And I walked down the, you know, hall, whatever, the aisle, and Edwin Hawkins runs up and starts talking to Peter. And Peter is gesturing wildly. And I'm thinking, he didn't tell them I'm coming. He just made me do this. So I was going to kill him. I was absolutely going to kill him. And he, you know, gestured to me to come on over and sing the song. So I did, you know, I started strumming and singing with all my life, you know, first of all, just because I was so nervous. And little by little, the Edwin Hawkins singers started singing on the chorus. And Edwin Hawkins threw up his hands. I guess, you know, he had told Peter no, and Peter just would not take no. So here I was presenting the song the first time to 46 incredibly big voices, and I was singing so with so much heart. I think they just, you know, caught it. So we went to the studio that day and we recorded the song.
Wow.
And it was an 8-minute version because nobody wanted to stop.
That is an amazing story to an amazing song. We are talking with folk singing icon Melanie, who is nominated for a Lifetime Achievement Award by the International Folk Music Awards. We're going to take a quick break here on the Stuff File program, and we'll continue talking with Melanie on the other side. This is, of course, the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Pay very close attention. There could be a test leader.
I rode my bicycle past your window last night. I roller skated to your door at daylight.
you got something for me? Oh, I got a brand new pair of roller skates. You got a brand new key.
Oh, I could listen to that song all day. That's just a taste of Melanie's brand new key. And you're listening to the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere for all your devices, such as Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, and Spotify, just to name a few. And of course, we continue talking with folk singing icon Melanie, who, as I mentioned, has been nominated for a Lifetime Achievement Award by the International Folk Music Awards. And Melanie, just before the break, you were talking about your time at Woodstock, and I want to touch on that right now. You were one of the very few women who performed at Woodstock. What was that experience like for you?
Again, you know, I got myself into things that I really didn't know. I was like Forrest Gump, you know, with a feather would fall on my shoulder and somehow I would be at Woodstock. But a year previous, the people who were putting it on were in the same office building as Peter's office. Peter was a record producer and we were a couple, you know, just talking. It was supposed to be called the Aquarian Exposition. That's the original name. It didn't sound like, you know, it's going to be the biggest thing in the world. It just sounded like arts and crafts and 3 days of peace and music. And I thought, well, that sounds nice, you know. And then it was a year in the planning, and I went off to follow other avenues. I was promoting things in England. I was writing a film score, and the Rolling Stones were in the studio next to me, and I was singing it. Sort of like places to be, you know. There was a place called the Revolution, and the Faces were there, and that was probably the most famous person I ever met, but he wasn't quite famous yet. Was Rod Stewart? He was just in a group, you know. You know, this was how I was spending my year that year. It was getting closer to the time of the festival, and we were actually deciding whether I should go or not. Between both of us, Peter said, I'll stay in the studio, you go back and do the festival. So I did, and I had no clue that it was what it was going to be. I mean, not many people did, but they certainly knew it was going to be bigger than I thought. You know, I was really picturing people with their kids on picnic blankets, you know, watching the fans, arts and crafts, and I was going to go shopping, you know. My mother picked me up. We headed out. I went up to Woodstock with my mother, and we hit traffic. That was the beginning of the mounting terror. And I got to this other hotel because the destination had changed, and I had to go to this other place. And we went to this hotel in Bethel Motel, a little motel, the most unlikely looking place to have assembled Janis Joplin, Sly Stone, as I walked in the hotel lobby. And again, I tell you that I had never met a famous person before. And here are all these stellar people. And I wanted to leave. I really did. I'm such an introvert by heart, you know, inside. Now I've learned to deal with it. I can think on my feet now, and I can do a lot more than I used to be able to. But I all I wanted to do was go home or go back to England and do what I was doing. I was recording a soundtrack and I was behind the scenes, and I quite liked that. And I didn't really want to be a famous person. I just wanted to do my music, you know. So a guy noticed me in the lobby, standing there probably dumbfounded. I said, Melanie, let's go to the helicopter. And we started trotting toward a helicopter. And I'd never been in a helicopter. You know, I don't like helicopters. You know, they just don't look like they were designed to fly. So I'm thinking, what am I doing going to a helicopter? Why can't we just go by car? So we were about to get in the helicopter, and he looks at my mother and he says, who's she? I said, it's my mother. And he said, oh, I'm sorry. No, Mom. Goodbye, Mom. Sorry, Mom. And I said goodbye to my mother, and I get in the helicopter, and I'm off on this adventure. And I looked down and I saw this. I didn't even realize it was people. I was thinking it's some kind of, I don't know, crop of some kind. And I asked the helicopter pilot, and he said, "That's people." I said, "But we're too far away. How could that be possibly be people?" And then he pointed to the stage, which was the size of a football field. And I almost fainted, really. I was so terrified, you can't even imagine. And as we descended, I heard Richie Havens singing, I think he was in his 40th minute of Freedom, Freedom. And I could tell, I had met him in the village, and I could tell that he was pretty panicked, you know. And I assumed that I was going to go on right after him. But as I got to the field, they led me to a little tent with a dirt floor, and I waited, and somebody came in and said, "You're on next," and then they said, "Never mind." And this went on all day, all day long.
So what was it like? What was it like for an like as you say, an introverted girl like yourself going on in
with just a guitar
and going on with all these stars and stepping out on stage with that huge, massive crowd? What was that like for you at that moment?
Well, I was sure that I was, my doom was about to begin, you know, that I was going to be, you know, booed off the stage. I mean, here I was armed only with a guitar. And I wasn't well known. I mean, the other thing is, you say I was the only woman, but I mean, one of three. The Janis Joplin was Janis and the Big Brother in the Holding Company, and of course Joan Baez was a legend, and I was unknown. I really, the only song that was being played at that point was what they called a turntable hit, because in the business then, a DJ could find the records, even if the record company didn't believe in it, which they didn't, and they didn't service radio stations. But a couple of copies went out, and this Roscoe, the DJ from WNEW in New York, played kind of underground things, you know, things he liked. And the only other stations that were playing me were in Europe, Pirate Radio, and Radio Caroline and Veronica, and they were playing my records. So when Roscoe started playing Beautiful People, it kind of took off, like other underground radio stations in the States started playing it. But I would say, you know, now a thing like that couldn't happen because it's all controlled, you know, radio is all controlled. But then the DJ had the way of, you know, if he liked a record, he played it. And the first time he played it, he called me Milani. But so one, maybe 1% of that audience knew that song when I started singing it, but they didn't know me. They didn't know my face. They didn't know my image or what I, there was nothing, you know, to, so when I did go on, I connected instantly with the 500,000 people that were there, which was remarkable in itself. And it could have been that I had a very outstanding, unbelievable experience. I actually left my body, and I wasn't doing any drugs. So it was, I guess, the sheer terror of waiting all day. And finally, it had started to rain, and Ravi Shankar went on, and I'm thinking everybody's going to go home for sure. I mean, they're not going to sit out in the rain, right? And right before I went on, I think it was Chipmunk or somebody made some kind of inspirational announcement about Hog Farm passing out thousands of candles, and everyone should keep the candles alight, and it would keep the rain or something away. And I didn't, you know, memorize it, but I just absorbed it. And that was the inspiration for Candles in the Rain. And everyone said, "You have to call the song Woodstock." And I had no, it's called Candles in the Rain. I mean, it was only, I only allowed them to put lay down in front of it because they said nobody will know that this song is called Candles in the Rain because you only say that once in the spoken part. And so, it, you know, you have to at least call it Woodstock. Please, Melanie, call it. No, I can't call it Woodstock. I'm going to call it Candles in the Rain.
One of the things that I find interesting is, as big as the hits were that you had in the United States, your songs seem to do even better, for instance, here in Canada and in places like Australia. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. When Peter and I first got together, he thought that I had a very international European appeal. He went after that. You know, and that was really unusual because, you know, American artists stayed in America. But he really thought that I had an international sound in my voice. We met Gilbert Beco, and he wanted to present me to the French public. And he presented me at the Olympia Theater in Paris in 1968. This was before Woodstock, and it was very unreal to me. I had always dreamt of, you know, living in France, like, I don't know, like in the days of the Salon, you know, with Gertrude Stein and that sort. But when I actually went to Paris and tried to speak French to people, I was not greeted with open arms with trying to speak French, you know. They would just say, oh, speak English, you know. Yeah, but my career did start in Europe. I think that has to do with, I was much more passionate than most female singers. You know, there were pop singers that felt it out like me.
One of the things that's rather unique about your songs as well is the fact that a lot of people have covered your work. How do you feel about some big stars who have taken a stab at your songs?
Oh, my gosh. When Ray Charles sang Look What They've Done to My Song, Ma, actually sang it the first time with Barbara Streisand on her television show, I couldn't believe it. You know, it was, for the first time I felt, I'm a writer. I wrote that song. And Ray Charles, who I admired, is singing it. And if Ray Charles is singing it, it must mean that I'm a real writer, you know. And but up until that point, it wasn't really spoken of much that I was a writer. Again, if they did talk about it, they just called me the female Bob Dylan.
I know about 6 years ago, there is a remake that you did. You performed Look What They Done with to My Song, Ma, with Miley Cyrus. How did that come about?
Yeah, well, she just did it, you know, and somebody said, Miley Cyrus is singing your song in the backyard session. So I listened, and it was really good. You know, I thought, she's really got a good voice. I like that. And I private messaged her on Facebook and said, I really like the way you did that. And she said, this is my life song. And yeah, I don't know, some other really nice things about it. And she said when she sang it to her then fiance, that is what he proposed to her after she did it. And we just kept in touch. And a little while later, she said, we have to do something together. And this was right after she had a wrecking ball. You know, she went from her backyard session, which was very, I don't know, what would you say, homey. You know, a little more granola cookie or something. And then she went from that to Wrecking Ball. And when she said, we have to do something together, it came flying out of my mouth. What will I wear? She had, you know, just been, and this was this major thing. Oh, Miley got naked. Oh, my God. And I mean, you know, people do things. You can have judgments and things, but, you know, there's, for me, a performer is the bravest person in the world. That and a man and woman who want to get married and have a kid. That's the two bravest things that people can do right now.
I know that, like so many artists, unfortunately, you've had issues with record labels and proper remuneration. What's interesting right about now is, as we speak, Taylor Swift is going through the process of re-recording all of her hits so that she owns the masters to the new version of them, and she can kind of freeze out those who own her music from the past. How do you feel about that, and is that something you'd like to do?
No. My situation and Taylor Swift's are completely different, but no, my actual copyright has been just, I never sold my copyright. You know, I've just been, and when my husband passed away, he handled all the business part of everything, but he never had a power of attorney or anything. So it's not, something's very, very wrong. And, you know, if I had the wherewithal that Taylor Swift had, I probably could do something like that and do lots of press releases about it and, you know, make myself a victim, which is my least favorite thing to do. But, no, it's very different, you know, and it's really easy to say, you know, oh, the music business is like that, and look at this story and that story. But mine is really different because I was with ASCAP and I never sold my writer's rights. But somebody's, lots of different entities are collecting them. So it's not just a matter of, well, I was with a record label. Again, I did make enemies in the record industry, unbeknownst to myself, just by opening a label. Mm. Nobody did that. Nobody opened record labels, you know, except the Beatles were the only people who had an independent thing going on. And again, they were with, I think, the lawyer who started, what was it? What record label? Well, Quartet, I think he was. And again, that's, you know, the Eastmans, and a lot of wealth was in that. And it took Paul McCartney forever and billions of dollars to get his rights back. So, you know, it's my situation is a little more like Paul McCartney's than it is Taylor Swift.
So what about new music? Is there new music coming out from Melanie?
That's what keeps me going, because when I first found out, you know, that I earn a lot of money but don't happen to receive it, the first, you know, feeling is you're violated. And you're being stolen from, you know, and it was very upsetting. And I talked to different legal people, and I found out that my plight was, you know, a long road. And I decided, you know what? I'm the same person who wrote those songs, and I still write. That's the one thing about an artist, is someone who creates, and you don't get older and stop creating. The only people who do are people who were in it for dubious reasons in the first place. Right. You know, they wanted to get a girlfriend, or they wanted to be wealthy, or they were just exhibitionists and wanted to have people look at me. But I think, you know, if you create and you enjoy that experience of communicating your little universe to the world, and that's why you do it, then that's why I do it. So I keep singing and writing. I wrote a bunch of new songs. I have to make the time, get it together to record an album of new material. And my son is my partner. He's an amazing guitarist, and he has also taught himself the studio, the engineering aspect, and in fact, that during the quarantine, he has taught himself video programs, and we've got chroma key down. You know, we did our first live stream a couple of weeks ago, I guess it is already, and it was an amazing success. We had a lot of people, and the quality was really good. So we're real happy with that. We're going to do another one. There was. 60 songs that people, you know, during your live stream, people are chatting. I might, if it wasn't in this digital format, I would think of it as hecklers, you know, because it would go all the way through your song, people saying things. Of course, it may not have been while you were singing, but, you know, it's distracting. I decided not to have the screen where people are commenting until the end. I'll watch it at the end. But it's almost like having, you know, people heckling during a show because it's hard to focus, you know. It's so difficult, you know, for a performer like me who, you know, I don't go out on stage with a rehearsed patter and walk stage right and go stage left and you know, sit on this song and stand on that one. It's just, I sing songs and I, you know, it has a lot to do with the audience, how, you know, it comes out.
Well, you are a great communicator, and your songs have moved and touched a lot of people, and I hope that continues to take place for many years to come. Melanie, it was an honor and pleasure to have a chance to talk with you. I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Okay, thank you so much.
Folk singing icon, Melanie. Oh, she really is a treasure. She touched on the fact that she recently did a live concert on Facebook just a few weeks ago, which was a hit. She will be doing another streaming concert, probably on Zoom. To find out more about it and how to get tickets, you can go to Melanie's website, which is melaniesafka.com. Safka is S-A-F-K-A, melaniesafka.com. The time and date is not yet set, but keep checking out on either her website, Facebook, or Instagram to learn when that next concert is coming up. And of course, you can check out my site at thestufffile.com. Check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0600, and you'll find the link to Melanie's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Here's a penny for your thoughts from the Stuff File program coming to you from Montreal, Canada, a country that doesn't have pennies.
And still to come on the program, we do indeed have an idiot of the day that's coming your way a little later on here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. We don't have time for any more Stuff File news, so we're going to get right to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program. Robert G. Penner is the author of Strange Labor, a post-apocalyptic novel. Now, although he's written many short stories, this is his debut novel. Robert joins us via Skype from the small western Pennsylvania town of Indiana. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. As a science fiction writer, I mean, we've lived through some interesting times, both politically and with the pandemic in the last little while. Is it easier or harder to create science fiction under these guidelines and milieus?
I think it's a little harder. It always feels like you're just writing about 5 minutes into the future. So I think it's getting tougher. There's two approaches. You can do the far future thing, which is the same as it's always been, although you still have to take into account things like global warming and pandemics. But I think when you're writing near future stuff, it's much tougher. But I think that's been kind of happening since at least the cyberpunks, where things feel like, where the future feels like it's already here a lot of the time, for all sorts of reasons.
Well, tell us about Strange Labor. What's it about and what time period are we talking about?
Just the very near future. It's a little unclear exactly when, but there's a post-apocalyptic event. There's this massive event in which the largest proportion of humanity wakes up one morning and just leaves the cities and starts digging these massive earthen mound works, these labyrinths or mazes out in the countryside. And they've ceased talking. They're just doing this all together. And there's a small fragment of the population that is not participating and doesn't understand what's happening or why it's happening. And the book is written from the perspective of one of these people in this sort of this remainder or this fragment, who's watching all this maze building and doesn't understand what's happening, but is also traveling across what had been the United States, trying to find out what happened to her parents, whether they've joined the mound builders or whether they, like her, exist in sort of this new marginal space. And so it's kind of a classic road novel, and she just encounters people on the way as she comes to terms with her new reality. But as I said, it's not very clear about how far into the future it is. It's just the future, the generic future.
And I understand the mound builders are people who had left urban centers. Is that correct?
Well, everyone else. So, I mean, it's written from the perspective of someone who was in New York City. So there's a sense in which there's this movement from urban to sort of rural or feral or wild milieus. But that's not the urban-rural distinction is not particularly important to the novel. What's really important is just that 95% of humanity is suddenly doing this very strange thing, and they've just sort of changed completely, and the people watching it have no idea why.
It can often be said that when people write science fiction, they're really writing about parallels of what's going on within our current lifetime or time frames. Was there anything that happened in our society that gave you the aha moment to write this book, Strange Labor?
I guess one could say sort of the continuing sort of untrammeled and explosive growth of a global capitalism might have something to do with it, the way we work and work and work and we produce and we produce and we produce, but there's not really a sense of genuine purpose anymore. So you could make the argument that that's sort of what I'm talking about when we talk about the diggers, but a few people who've read the book have a very different view of things and would say that the diggers actually represent something else. But I think just the idea of work, why do we work? And how do we work and what motivates us to work, which is a very real concern for everyone alive today. I would say that's probably the kernel of the book. I wasn't very focused on it once I started writing, but I think just that idea of sort of we work all the time and we don't understand why, not really. And so when the pandemic happened and all of a sudden people's attitudes towards work changed, it was kind of... it was kind of an eerie moment for me because that's kind of what I was writing about, is like how is work just a part of our life and our psyche? And then all of a sudden this pandemic happens and for a lot of people, work life got turned upside down and they sort of had to start looking at it differently and thinking about it differently. And I guess, obviously I couldn't anticipate that was going to happen, but there are some queer parallels between what happened following the beginnings of the pandemic and lockdowns and what happens in the book that are all related to how a society organizes sort of economics and labor.
Well, it's interesting being a science fiction writer. You made a point just a few moments ago that I want to dig a little deeper into. You said that some people have had a different interpretation as to what your writing means when they read your book, either with short stories or with this novel. Is that always an interesting concept when you write something and people get a different feeling out of it or a different interpretation than what you may have intended?
Yeah, I actually, it's I really like it in general. It's very exciting to see words you've put down on paper being reinterpreted and re-understood. And sometimes people will draw things out of the text that you had no idea were there, but are clearly there. And it's very exciting to have a good reader do that and say, look what you were writing about. This is very interesting. This applies to me, right? And you didn't know you were writing about that. And yet they can make it about something new and interesting. I mean, there's always the danger of someone imposing sort of ideas on your text that you find abhorrent and that you hope aren't there. But in general, I find it a wonderful experience to have someone see something in the text that was not there. It's actually quite motivating to keep writing, to have those kinds of surprising responses.
As we mentioned, you are in Indiana, Pennsylvania, which is where you live, a small western town there. You told me off air that it's the hometown of Jimmy Stewart. But you're Canadian. How did we lose you?
Well, you haven't lost me. We'll be heading back soon enough. But my wife, my partner, got a job down here. I'm teaching at the local university. So we moved down. We've been down here for about 6 or 7 years, I think. But this spring we'll probably be heading back to Winnipeg.
Back to Winnipeg. And when this is something I often ask of science fiction writers, because I think it bores well to what they write about and how they write. Do you consider yourself an optimistic or pessimistic person?
I'm a pessimist. Absolutely. And so one of the things that's useful when you're writing science fiction, for me personally, is it kind of forces you out of that pessimism, and it forces you to imagine that the future is in fact possible, and that it's possible in a wide variety of ways, that we're not locked into a specific or a certain path. But I am absolutely pessimistic, and writing and science fiction in particular is kind of therapeutic to that pessimism. It forces me to sort of examine and re-examine it.
Well, as someone who is a science fiction writer, I mean, this book came out in 2020, but I'm just curious to know how the year 2020 is affecting your writing going forward.
I would say it's not having a huge impact either way. My family's all at home now. So, I mean, that they impinge. My daughter goes to school online, and my partner teaches online. So they impinge on my routines a little more than they had in the past, when I was able to just write during the day. But other than that, it hasn't had a big impact. It just forced a change in routines. Maybe it forces sort of new ideas into focus. You're just forced to think about things in ways you haven't before, and to not take sort of social and economic and cultural structures for granted when you're writing. You start maybe examining how they're constructed and how they're limited, and how they change and can change quite radically over time, because the pandemic forced so much change. But in my writing, that's just been pretty much on pace as before.
So what's next for you? I mean, the book is out now, Strange Labor. Do you anticipate that maybe it could be turned into a television event or a film? Are you working on other things beyond this?
Well, that's the dream, the television event or the film. Yeah, I'm writing all the time. So I'm constantly writing short stories, and I'm working on two other major projects at the moment. The one I'm concentrated on the most is a historical fiction that sort of drifts towards the speculative. That's set in the 19th century Canadian fur trade, more or less. And that's based on sort of archival work I did when I was doing my PhD in history a few years ago. And I'm also playing around with sort of a space opera idea. But lots of short story writing. There's always lots of short story writing going on.
In the meantime, the book is now out. It's called Strange Labor. Robert, thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you.
Robert G. Penner, author of Strange Labor. You can go to my website at thestumpfile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0600, and you'll find the links to Robert's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's that moment you've all been waiting for, boys and girls. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Sometimes, if you run out of your favorite product, you have to improvise, but it's probably best to avoid this particular swap. Tessica Brown ran out of her got-to-be glued spray, which is a setting spray that one would use in their hair. So she figured she would use Gorilla Glue adhesive spray instead. Now, any of you out there who owns a TV, you've probably seen the commercials for Gorilla Glue, and if you've bought some, you probably read the label before using. By the way, those commercials are everywhere.
Original Gorilla Glue expands into the materials to form an incredibly strong bond. Original Gorilla Glue for the toughest jobs on planet Earth.
For the record, hair is not one of the toughest jobs on planet Earth. Anyway, while it did indeed set her hair, she's now been trying to remove it for a month. Posting on TikTok and Instagram, Jessica explained just how many times she's washed it since.
My hair, it don't move. You hear what I'm telling you? It don't move. I've washed my hair 15 times and it don't move.
People flock to the comment section to offer advice, including everything from applying tea tree oil to mayonnaise. But nothing seemed to work, and she eventually headed to hospital to see if they could do anything to help. She says she's not able to shave her head because the glue is too tight against her scalp. The folks at Gorilla Glue have said that the only solution it could suggest would be to saturate her hair in rubbing alcohol, then gently comb it out before shampooing. But, they added, if Tessica's hair had been stuck for a month, as she says, it's likely fractured at the root, but we certainly hope for the best. Tessica eventually flew to Los Angeles, where she underwent 4 hours of surgery with a Beverly Hills plastic surgeon who performed the $12,500 surgery for free. Now, Tessica realizes she did wrong.
Bad idea.
Still, she's not taking full responsibility. She's thinking of hiring an attorney, because she feels the label for Gorilla Glue is misleading since it says multi-use and only warns against usage on the eyes, skin, or clothing, but fails to mention hair in the list. You know what I think, Tessica?
Bad idea.
Because why? Oh, why? Would you think that using Gorilla Glue on your hair as a setting spray would be a good alternative to products that are actually designed for such a purpose? One reason. And one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0600. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links to all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0600. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, Vernon Square Radio, KDXRadio.com, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, CKUW-FM in Winnipeg, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Today's broadcast could be heard directly in your home, car, or wireless device, or on your computer, so you can listen on an outpatient basis. For those of you hearing this show directly inside your head, please adjust your medication.